Big news. One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
On the program today, a little bit of data, a whole lot of what regular people think about that data, and hey, what do you think about Birkenstocks? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 11th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, you want to do business and economic reporting. To some extent, you got to rely on the data. It helps you know what's going on. But you want to know what the data means, you got to talk to people. They help you know what's actually what. The data in question today is the September Producer Price Index, inflation at the wholesale level. It went up 0.5% in September from August, more than the experts had been guessing. But again, people, in this case, the people seeing a lot of those wholesale costs firsthand, small businesses that then sell to us. So we gave some of our small business regulars a call today.
Well, it's a little early.
I had to get my Starbucks fuel to start the day. So here we are.
You know, usual Wednesday morning. Grabbed a grilled cheese sandwich, and I'm here.
That was In Order Irene Kesselman at Alley Cat Toys in Carrboro, North Carolina. Kalina Bruce at Noir Lux Candle Company up in Seattle. And Eric Vaughn, he's the owner of Eric's I've Been Framed. That's a custom framing shop in Detroit. The basic question to them was what they are seeing. First up, frames.
The shipping has increased, and, you know, we've had to make adjustments, and, you know, I kind of have to pass that along to the client.
And that can get tricky.
I had someone earlier to come in that they wanted to frame up this photograph of Aretha Franklin, and she wanted to do something a little more special.
And?
I told her how much it cost. She says, oh, no. So she likes Aretha. She don't like her that much, I don't think. So we scaled back. And we ended up going with something more in her price range.
All right, toys next. Irene Kesselman, here you go.
Costs right now, I would say, are steady. I think in my industry.
That sounds fine.
We've actually seen some decreases. I think I'm starting to see prices kind of go back to where they were a couple years ago.
Huh. Finally, candles. Here's Kalina Bruce.
Costs are consistently inconsistent right now.
In other words,
we are seeing like incremental increases. It may not seem like a lot, you know, initially, but then when you start to do these bulk orders, you're like, oh, this order is $50 more than the last time that I ordered, and it's the same exact thing.
She's not raising prices, but she is making some changes.
So we're looking at vessels that may be, you know, a different size or a different material or, you know, something like that, that we could offer at a lower price point.
So that was retailers and how they are dealing with wholesale inflation. Tomorrow, it's consumer inflation, the September Consumer Price Index. On Wall Street today, copacetic as they waited for that inflation reading. We will have the details when we do the numbers. A quick perusal of the Birkenstock website today will tell you that you can get a pair of their iconic sandals for $130, give or take. A quick perusal of stock market websites today will tell you that you can get a share of Birkenstock for $40, give or take, which was, as of the closing bell, a little bit more than 12% below the $46 at which those shares started trading today. The footwear company is the latest to test the public offering waters following the chip designer Arm and the delivery app Instacart last month. Birkenstock, though, is very far from the usual shiny new startup we have seen in IPO eras past. It's been selling the same, well, let's call them sensible shoes for half a century, and the company itself has been around for almost 250 years. So why is it going public now? Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
They may not be the sexiest shoes in the world, but Birks and their signature orthopedic footbed inspire a loyal following, including health policy worker Emma Adelson in Chicago.
They have a really big community surrounding them.
And she wanted to be part of that community, which has expanded from the stereotypical crunchy granola crowd to a wider audience who see them as a design classic. Adelson saved up $100 and change to buy her first pair during her senior year of college 7 years ago, and they're still going strong.
They're not making them to break down in a couple years. They're just really versatile. I feel like you can still pair them with a pair of jeans or a skirt or a dress or whatever you're wearing. They look good.
Not fashionable, exactly, but good.
Cool things are not necessarily beautiful in a classical definition of the term.
Thomai Sardari is a marketing professor at NYU who often sports a pair of gold Birkenstock two-strap Arizona sandals.
It's a brand with legacy and continuity. They have a heritage.
The family-owned company has been making the same styles in the same factory in Germany for decades. But she says it's also kept innovating. It's taken investment from an arm of luxury brand LVMH and launched limited collaborations with fashion designers and the hottest movie of the summer, Barbie.
You can go back to your regular life, or you can know the truth about the universe. The choice is now yours.
The first one, the high heel.
Barbie eventually chooses the practical Birkenstock sandals, in pink, of course, and a brand that represents that more down-to-earth truth about the universe could be attractive to investors, too, says analyst Zachary Waring at CFRA. The IPO market has seen its ups and downs over the last couple years, and he says glittering high-growth unicorns are no longer the only game in town.
You're looking at more companies that are established, that are growing, but they're growing profitably.
Nothing frumpy about that. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Nothing frumpy about us either. We've got a podcast, you know, if you miss something on the air, you can get it at marketplace.org or follow us, subscribe at the platform of your choice. The International Energy Agency says electric vehicles accounted for 8% of all car sales in this country last year. The Biden administration wants that share to be higher, much higher. And to that end, in the Inflation Reduction Act, made provisions for a $7,500 tax credit if you buy an EV. Terms and conditions, of course, apply. The news is that the Internal Revenue Service says you can get that credit up front now at the point of sale, if you will, instead of having to wait till you file your taxes. That becomes effective in January. It is, indeed, behavioral economics at work, as Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall explains.
American consumers have two priorities when they're in the market for a new vehicle, says Stephanie Brinley with S&P Global Mobility. They like it to be simple.
And they have a tendency to focus on monthly payment rather than the overall purchase price.
Brinley says the instant rebate addresses both of those things. It's simpler, and because buyers have to borrow thousands less,
that can immediately affect your monthly payment price.
Upfront incentives like this have a proven track record. UC Davis economist Eric Mueliger has compared instant sales tax waivers with tax credits that were worth more but came later.
The sales tax waivers had a much larger impact on hybrid vehicle adoption. They were very easy to claim, and they occurred at the time of purchase.
In St. Petersburg, Florida, Greg Solaire has roughly 30 Chevy Bolts on the lot at his dealership. He expects this program will help move them.
You got to wait a long time to get that tax refund. And being able to get it right up front, it's going to make it a lot more palatable for a lot of customers.
EVs will be even more affordable in states with incentives of their own, like Colorado. That's where Clay Stranger works for RMI, a clean energy think tank.
With $7,500 federal incentive combined with a $5,000 state incentive, we're looking at close to $13,000 of available tax credit, which really can help pull that cost premium of new electric vehicles down.
But it's not just costs that have consumers wary of EVs. Darren Whitehurst with the Texas Automobile Dealers Association says charging infrastructure isn't there yet, especially in rural areas.
If you live in Pecos, Texas, you're not going to buy an EV because you can't get to Odessa and back on a charge if you're running your air conditioner.
He says in Texas, he doubts how much this federal program will shift consumer demand. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
There's a new law on the books in New York as of last month, actually, that requires most companies to include salary ranges in job postings. Same thing in California as of the beginning of this year and a handful of other states as well. They are aimed, these laws are, at reducing wage gaps, most particularly for women and people of color, and also just generally at creating transparency in the workplace. But as Marketplace's Henry App reports, not every company seems to want that.
It's been perfectly legal for most workers to discuss their compensation since the 1930s, thanks to the National Labor Relations Act. But it's only recently they've felt comfortable actually doing that, says Aaron Terrazas, chief economist at Glassdoor.
You know, it used to be that the rule of workplaces is you don't talk money or politics. Increasingly, that's out of date.
But every time Kestrel Swift brought up pay transparency with his manager, he says he got shot down.
The communication was always just like, yeah, I just don't think upper management is going to go for that.
Swift was a software developer at a company called Vermont Information Processing, or VIP. It makes digital tools for the beverage industry. When some of his coworkers decided to share their salaries anyway, he was excited. Here's how they tell it. In February 2022, Kestrel's colleague Caleb Noble was up for a promotion, and he wanted to get a sense of what other people in the same position were making. So he says he reached out to another coworker, Chris Bendel.
So I sent a message to Chris being like, hey, Chris, like, do you mind sharing your salary with me? It's okay if you do not.
Chris was happy to share, and he suggested they take it a step further.
Chris was like, okay, we should just make a spreadsheet so this is public to everybody at the company so that everyone has this information to be able to fight for their salaries.
They created a Google spreadsheet where employees could voluntarily share, anonymously if they wanted to, and they passed it to two coworkers, including Kestrel Swift, who passed it along to others, he says.
Within like an hour, it just totally took off.
About 30 employees signed on. But then the four guys noticed an icon at the top of the spreadsheet. A member of the company's upper management was lurking in the document. Chris Bendel was working from home at the time.
Within 30 minutes, you know, I'm sitting here at this desk I'm sitting at right now. My computer just shuts off. And I was like, oh no, I must have lost power or something.
He'd been fired. The other three spreadsheet creators say they complained about Chris's firing, and within days, they were all fired too. And they thought it was pretty clear. This was punishment for making and distributing that pay transparency spreadsheet. So they filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board. And this past summer, an administrative law judge ruled in their favor. He ordered VIP to pay damages and offer the four their jobs back. The company appealed that decision to the full NLRB. VIP's lawyer declined an interview request, but in its appeal, the company said it fired those employees in part because they disparaged a planned reorg and talked about quitting, not because of the spreadsheet. This kind of dispute is something that the wave of new state laws could prevent by requiring companies to list salary ranges up front in job postings.
And so you have now transparency, not just between two coworkers, but also between firms.
Zoe Cullen is an assistant professor of economics at Harvard. She says these laws can have an effect within companies, too.
If a firm has to make public a salary range, then internally they will also have pressure to essentially stick to that range and potentially reduce pay gaps between two people.
But if those laws are going to work, job seekers have an important role to play, says Aaron Terrazas at Glassdoor.
Ultimately, I think kind of the enforcement mechanism here has to be job seekers and job candidates choosing, you know, to apply to companies that are transparent and not apply to companies that are not.
All four former VIP employees have found new jobs, and most of them have noticed a very different culture in their new workplaces, like Chris Bendel.
There's a large group of people at my company who have adopted the practice of putting their salary in their Slack subscription.
Slack being the messaging service a lot of companies use.
And it's as transparent as it can be. And when I saw that, I was like, this is awesome.
And there's no need to pass around a spreadsheet. I'm Henry Epp for Marketplace.
Coming up.
That flies completely in the face of the intention of the original act.
What counts, do you suppose, as the genuine article, and who gets to decide? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 65 points today, almost 0.2%, closed at 33,804. The NASDAQ added 96 points, 0.7%, 13,659. The S&P 500 up 18 points, a little bit more than 0.4%, 43.76. ExxonMobil, you might have heard this, is spending $64.5 billion to buy the shale oil firm Pioneer Natural Resources and thus more than double its footprint in the Permian Basin out in Texas. Shares down 3.6%. Pioneer added 1.4%. The CEO of health insurer Humana has announced he'll be stepping down next year after more than a decade in that job. Shares weakened 1.4%. There's a new CEO at Walgreens Boots Alliance. Tim Wentworth comes to the drugstore chain from a pharmacy benefits management firm. Shares added almost 1%. Today, Goldman Sachs taking another step away from consumer banking by selling its home improvement loan arm to a consortium of investors. Goldman down almost 0.6% today. Bond prices went up. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell again, 4.56% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace. Big news, one generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Should you not be a regular reader of the Federal Register? Well, we are here for you. This morning, the Federal Trade Commission announced and will soon be publishing in the aforementioned register a proposed rule to ban hidden junk fees, the charges that pop up and surprise you after you have bought something. Charges that can, of course, add a whole lot to the cost of concert tickets and resort stays and apartment rentals, too. That last one is a big one. A lot of renters, especially in bigger buildings, are getting hit with fees on top of their monthly rent and utilities, and they don't always know about them before they sign that lease. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
Last week on the show, some of you may remember, we did a story about young people looking for housing in this expensive competitive rental market. One of the people we introduced you to was Anna Mayo. She's 22, just graduated from college, and lives in Duluth, Minnesota. And one thing she told me was that she kept coming across apartments that looked like they were in her budget at first, but actually weren't.
There's a really big rental company in Duluth that I would say owns the majority of rental properties. And the amount of fees that they tack on every month for completely arbitrary things is absurd.
The rent itself was already high, at the top of her budget.
And then they said, oh, it's going to be hundreds of dollars of extra fees per month, too.
She says there were fees for putting in maintenance requests online, fees for calculating each apartment's share of the utilities, and all sorts of other things. She decided to pass on those buildings. But often, Ariel Nelson at the National Consumer Law Center says tenants don't find out about all the fees before they sign a lease.
And a lot of times they're mandatory. A lot of times they're for services that people don't want.
Such as a valet trash fee, which would cover someone picking up your trash from right outside your apartment and walking it down the hall to the trash room. And Nelson says in buildings that have fees, there are often a bunch.
And you realize once you're on the other side of your lease agreement that actually the rent is something like $300 more than you thought.
That's what the FTC's new proposed rule is trying to prevent. It wouldn't ban landlords and management companies from charging fees, but it would require they tell tenants about them up front. Marie-Claire Tran-Leung at the nonprofit National Housing Law Project says that will help tenants, but
sometimes even when those fees are disclosed, the tenants don't really have the power to fight back against those fees.
Or have many other options to turn to. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
For as long as there's been a market for Native American art in this country, there have been fraudsters looking to profit. There is a law meant to prevent that, or deter it anyway, depending on how big the fakery is. Stiff fines, even jail time. It's called the Indian Arts and Crafts Act, first passed in 1935, updated in 1990. And now the Department of the Interior is looking to modernize it yet again and has proposed a couple of changes, one of which would let Native artists rely on non-Native workers, thus raising questions, as Marketplace Savannah Marr reports, about what exactly counts as Native art here in 2023.
At Santa Fe Indian Market earlier this year, Aquinnah Wampanoag artist Elizabeth James Perry shows some of her wampum jewelry to a potential buyer.
We carve it and we make, you know, beautiful beaded pieces for adornment as well as treaty and record keeping. It's a rich tradition.
A centuries-old tradition of hand-carving every wampum bead in every piece she sells. Which is why James Perry is uneasy about one proposed update to the Indian Arts and Crafts Act, or ICA, that would, for the first time, explicitly allow Native artists to rely on non-Native labor in some situations and still market their work as Indian-made.
Some of us do and expect to do all of our work ourselves.
She's on board with some of the Interior Department's other proposed changes, like expanding ICA protection to Native Hawaiians and to new disciplines like media and performing arts. But for a lot of traditional artists like her, the non-Native labor thing is concerning.
I recognize those concerns.
That's Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs Brian Newland. He's Ojibwe.
But we want to make sure that we're also recognizing the diversity of art in Indian country.
Newland says there's more to the Indian art economy than traditional handmade items.
Indian people have a right to define art in each generation going forward. It's not static.
And he says the Indian Arts and Crafts Act shouldn't be either. Tani Atone, a Kiowa textile artist, says contemporary Native artists should be able to use outside help to grow their businesses.
I would see it as an investment.
Atone sews dresses, skirts, and powwow regalia from fabric printed with her drawings.
I pay an Austrian guy to print my original artwork onto the fabric, but it's only because he's put up the $150,000 for the printing machine
Atone says a little outsourcing doesn't make her or her art less Indian. But skeptics worry that big native-led companies could exploit this new proposed rule and market mass-produced items as native art.
That flies completely in the face of the intention of the original act.
Dallin Mabee is Seneca in Northern Arapaho. He's former director of the Southwestern Association for Indian Arts and an artist himself. He says this proposal serves a new kind of native artist who has built a brand around their work, maybe through social media, and been able to scale up.
That blurs the line between brand and production, especially mass production, and the creation of fine art as a vehicle of cultural preservation.
The Department of Interior's proposal is not set in stone. Assistant Secretary Newland says the department is weighing public comments and will put out a new draft by early next year. Wampum artist Elizabeth James Perry says the Indian Arts and Crafts Act protects more than artists' livelihoods. And she wonders,
how is that non-native production helping native communities and people? I think I would just need to know a lot more, really. At the end of the day, is it helping us to sustain ourselves?
The only occasional studio help she gets is from her 7-year-old nephew, who likes to watch her work. James Perry hopes that learning about wampum carving will keep him connected to his homeland. In Santa Fe, I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, you might have noticed the general macroeconomic calm the past 4 days, despite the horrific violence in the Middle East. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen was asked about that today ahead of the World Bank and IMF annual meeting in Marrakesh.
While we're monitoring potential economic impacts from the crisis, I'm not really thinking of that as a major likely driver of the global economic outlook.
Case in point, crude oil, which can be a major driver of the global economic outlook, down another 2% today. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context, though, in which we read the minutes of the most recent Fed meeting so you don't have to, just like the Federal Register from a couple of stories ago. Here's the operative passage from the Fed's minutes. A majority of participants judged that one more increase in the target federal funds rate would likely be appropriate, while some judged it likely that no further increases would be warranted. Or, and it's a pity you can't actually see me right now, the shruggy emoji, right? Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry. It's a good thing I amused myself. Jessen Dueler, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.